Good afternoon. Welcome to the Federalist Society's conference on all things CFPB. I am Dean Reuter, Senior Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. I'm very pleased to welcome you here today and then to fade into the background. My sole responsibility is to introduce Brian Johnson. He is a partner at Alston & Byrd's Financial Services and Products Group and the Consumer Financial Services team. More importantly, I think for our purposes today, Brian served as Deputy Director of the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where he was responsible for policy development, strategic planning, and execution of the CFPB's statutory supervision, examination, enforcement, rulemaking, and research activities. He conceived and led the creation of high-profile agency initiatives, including the Office of Innovation, the Task Force on Federal Consumer Financial Law, and the Call for Evidence RFI series, policy symposia series, and Start Small, Save Up emergency savings program. So he had a lot on his plate in a short period of time there. Brian held various positions before that on Capitol Hill, including oversight of the activities of the CFPB, but also FSOC, the FDIC, the Office of Financial Research, the OCC, Federal Reserve System, and then NCUA, which is the National Credit Union Administration. He's earned his BA in economics and his JD, both from the University of Virginia. And very importantly, he's the primary organizer of today's program. He's going to act as our MC and moderator of everything we see today. So with that, Brian, welcome.
Thank you, Dean. Welcome and thank everyone for tuning in to today's event. Wednesday of this week marks the 10-year anniversary of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau first opening its doors. This young agency was created by the Dodd-Frank Act, was born out of the crucible of the financial crisis, was the brainchild of then professor and now U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren. Congress granted the CFPB broad and novel administrative authorities over bank and non-bank financial institutions, and designed it to be highly independent from the political branches of government. Early leaders of the agency dubbed it the cop on the beat and sought to quickly establish it as a financial watchdog to be reckoned with. At the same time, the agency has been the subject of or affected by landmark legal disputes involving constitutional separation of powers questions like the scope of the president's recess appointment power and removal power and the legislative power of the purse, as well as other foundational jurisprudential concepts of federalism, fair notice, and due process of law. These issues and the CFPB's activities during three different presidencies have often been politically polarizing. Indeed, strong and enduring differences of opinion exist regarding the agency's policy decisions and the underlying philosophical considerations of the proper scope of American consumer financial regulation. Today, we aspire to rise above the partisan fray and use the CFPB's 10th birthday as an appropriate opportunity to objectively evaluate the CFPB's legacy and future. We have assembled panels of former policymakers, leading academics, and distinguished legal practitioners with diverse viewpoints who have thought about, written about, worked within, and interacted with the CFPB throughout its history. They know the real CFPB inside and out, and we are fortunate that they will be sharing their experiences and insights with us today. Let us now turn to our keynote speaker, Kathy Kraninger. Kathy became director of the CFPB in December 2018. From her early days as a Peace Corps volunteer to her role establishing the Department of Homeland Security to her policy work at the Office of Management and Budget to the CFPB, Kathy has dedicated her career to public service. She came to the CFPB from the Office of Management and Budget, where she was Policy Associate Director. She oversaw the budgets for executive branch agencies, including the Departments of Commerce, Justice, Homeland Security, HUD, Transportation, and Treasury, in addition to 30 other government agencies. Previously, she worked in the U.S. Senate, where she was clerk for the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security. On Capitol Hill, she also worked for the House Appropriations Subcommittee of Homeland Security, as well as the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. She served in executive branch posts with the Department of Transportation. There, after the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, she volunteered to join the leadership team that set up the newly created DHS. Her work at DHS led to awards, including the Secretary of Homeland Security's Award of Exceptional Service, the International Police and Public Safety's 9/11 Medal, and the Meritorious Service Public Service Award from the United States Coast Guard. She graduated magna cum laude from Marquette University and earned a law degree from Georgetown University Law Center. She also served as a U.S. Peace Corps volunteer in Ukraine. Kathy, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Fantastic to be with you. Always also good to see you, Brian. So thank you. And thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this forum.
Well, if I slip and call you boss, please forgive me for that. So I will note that at the outset today is not a keynote address, but rather a fireside chat. And since we're doing this remotely, we don't have a fire aside which to sit. But I was quite interested in hearing about your background, maybe to start this conversation prior to the CFPB. I read your bio, of course, which can't do that experience justice, but it undoubtedly, you know, shaped your view of good government. You were in and around different departments and agencies from a management perspective, you know, inside DHS as a startup, which is similar in some ways to the startup of CFPB, the youngest financial regulator. What is it about your background in government service that you thought best prepared you for walking into the CFPB director seat?
Yeah. Well, it really is certainly that DHS experience and that startup dynamic in government. There, frankly, in history, are not that many opportunities to be involved at the beginning stages of an agency and really helping it form its mission. And I do feel pretty fortunate that I have been in those seminal places in history and been able to really be engaged. I think that's what makes public service most rewarding to me, is really knowing that you are adding value, making a huge difference, and helping the country and helping the American people and you know, doing, you know, what is so important in these public service jobs. So certainly 9/11 was a very catalyzing event, recognizing that we needed to do something fundamentally different in the stand up of TSA, the stand up of DHS. And I was also involved in standing up an office called the Screening Coordination Office at DHS. And so that history of everyone kind of coming together, the mission being core, having just great leaders that want to be involved and help. All of the stories that I talked to folks who were involved at the very early stages of the CFPB, from that small team at Treasury to those that decided to come over from other agencies, certainly experts in consumer finance from the outside. You know, that same experience and really that passion for the mission is something that I can truly identify with and have felt and enjoyed. I think the other thing, though, is definitely the way that you work in government, for good or for bad. You know, you've got congressional committees that fight over jurisdiction. They create new agencies or new offices, and there are often tentacles to those other either prior legacy agencies that might have had that responsibility before, or shared jurisdiction. The DHS had that. Early on, we had tons and tons of interagency meetings. I was at the White House regularly on behalf of DOT and then DHS, but meeting with Justice and meeting with transportation also, and trying to figure out how those lines should be drawn and how the responsibility should work. The CFPB, I think in some cases didn't really do that when it started off. And there was a continued effort that needed to happen when I came in to try to, again, continue to make sure that it was part of the fabric of the financial regulatory system. And so I was well-versed in how that interagency world operates, how other agencies think about this. And the last thing I would say about just public service generally is the leaders who I have had the true fortune of working under, who were truly motivated by doing what was right. Certainly there's a philosophical perspective that we all bring and our own values. but really making sure that doing right by the mission, having the law as the, you know, really guiding document, seminal document, and what is it that Congress told us to do, and how do we most effectively go about doing it, and, you know, manage people in a way that is consistent with those values. I can speak certainly very affectionately about Secretary Norm Mineta, who was the Democrat in Bush's cabinet, who chaired, who was Secretary of Transportation, and was really the first, you know, kind of key leader I worked under. Just, you know, cared about people, showed that. You could not rush that man out of a meeting. It was really like, we'll take the time we need to take, and I want to get to know you, and all of those things about how you best treat people, and how that in the long run that actually helps you get things done. And as I said, I've been very, very fortunate to work around and with some pretty fantastic people who showed that. And just the way that he led transportation, and I saw it in many other places that I worked in. Certainly, many politicians are good people as well, which is a good trait to have. But it really does matter on how you motivate and empower people and get them excited. So I've had a lot of experience in watching that and doing that, and I think it served me well coming over to the CFPB. And it's what, you know, what makes it enjoyable and fun too. The last thing I'll say is I had a colleague who was a very serious, Coast Guardsman, went over to the civilian side. But whenever I said I had fun in the job, he'd kind of look at me funny and say, like, no, this is a duty. This is a, you know, responsibility. I'm like, if it wasn't fun, I wouldn't do it. So that's also part of the dynamic of finding that fun and finding good people to work with.
Well, speaking of fun of the job, one important aspect of becoming director is, of course, going through the nomination and confirmation process. And I think you'd be maybe the first person I've heard discuss that confirmation hearing as fun. They tend to be, I think, in this day and age, quite contentious. What, you know, walk us back to that point in time. You were sitting at OMB. At some point, it became clear you were going to be the nominee. What's the, for folks who haven't been through that process, other than, you know, myself on the outside looking in, it looks like a pretty painful process to, you know, take a beating from senators who are usually, you know, sending larger messages than, you know, maybe evaluating qualifications. What is that process like? What was your kind of experience there? What were your takeaways from that process?
I'm lucky. I grew up with a pretty thick skin with three brothers. So I am able to take that incoming flack and continue to plow forward, because it is an incredibly challenging process. There's no doubt about it. Some for certainly good reason. And then when you're in a truly politicized position like director of CFPB, which unfortunately, you know, I really did want to take that political temperature down around that job, but I don't think that's going to happen in the long run. It was certainly worth a try. You and I have talked a lot about that, but being in that truly politicized role was definitely challenging. But again, things it makes, you know, if it's not hard, it's probably also not worth undertaking. And so this was something that when I was approached about it, I really had to think long and hard about it. You know, again, what you want to put your family through. There was a postcard campaign, which I shocked the heck out of me. I've spent my career working across the aisle in every job I've ever had. I never care, frankly, where someone is. If they want to actually find a solution and move forward, that's what I love about policymaking. And so regardless of who you worked for, that was what I sought out. And to have myself painted as someone who was extreme or somehow irresponsible, that is obviously something that you know, you really do find it a little hard sometimes to move forward with and take with that grain of salt. So I feel really lucky to have great support. harder to watch my parents, you know, and many people told me about watching their faces behind me during the hearing. But my family really is incredibly supportive of everything I've done. And look, I worked on the Hill. I worked in the administration. I have helped numerous nominees go through the process. I've helped senators prepare for nominees and done all of the, you know, kind of process for the, from the committee side on how nominees are managed. So this was something I knew well, was comfortable with. I knew what was happening on the other side of it. Even when you're going through it yourself, that at least is helpful. And I'd say too, like many other people, talking about yourself is probably one of the most uncomfortable things that you have to do. Put subject matter in front of me. We can have debate and dialogue, but when you realize yourself are actually the source of this conversation and controversy, that part becomes, also difficult to respond to. But look, the senators, as you said, they had a job to do, and they took the tack they decided to take publicly. I continue to maintain a lot of relationships on both sides of the aisle. I did not take any of that personally in terms of, you know, internalizing it and seeking, to take future action as a result of how I was treated, and still continue to try to treat people the way I would like to be treated, and perhaps not exactly the way they're taking me on. So it's a challenging process. I'm hoping that, you know, people watching my hearing aren't discouraged by it. I think that's the only concern I have about this. The nastier it gets, the less likely good people are to want to take this on, want to take the reputational risk otherwise that comes with it. But it is, public service remains something that I really value and I found rewarding. And so I don't regret it at all, but it is a brutal process.
So let's fast forward. You navigated those waters successfully, earned a confirmation vote. You know, you joined the Bureau in December 2018 in the midst of the first major leadership transition in the agency's young history. You know, came in on after the, you know, service of Acting Director Mulvaney, who had been an acting director for about the course of a year. What were, you know, coming into the Bureau in that context, what were your first impressions of the agency when you walked in the door, started meeting with staff? Early on, you went on a listening tour, to visit each of the regional offices for the agency and hear from staff, among other folks. What, you know, if you think back to the early part of your tenure, what was your first impression of the Bureau?
That mission focus was absolutely the first. I know I talked a second about that, but that was very much, it came through. People cared about the mission. Also, the ability to create an agency from whole cloth also means you get in a bunch of talented people, frankly, and talented people that are really focused on that mission. So that was definitely the first impression I had. But also then those parallels in the startup dynamic, you know, where are the touch points, connections, deep relationships with peer agencies? You know, how do we operate? I'm someone that loves to get into, and that's why the listening tour was so important, but get into the observation of how have things been done? You know, how do you think about them? Having those conversations one-on-one in small groups, you know, meeting the staff, meeting all of the partners that we worked with. And that was a great way to really dive in. So certainly they care about the mission. And then just all of the trust dynamics, which are unfortunate, but certainly stem from the history of the agency and its creation, having come from, as you noted, the financial crisis, having the debate as to whether Republicans, you know, even thought this agency should exist. And I can tell you that I think I have said this publicly before, but there are many agencies, to my mind, that probably confuse the effective operation of government and the effective carrying out of the mission, because there are just so many agencies. We're terrible in government. We create new things, but then we never actually downsize or stop doing things that don't work anymore and discontinue those things. So defunding something is pretty hard. So I don't have the CFPB at the top of my list of agencies that should not exist. I approached it as Congress decided they should. It's a mission that's important and we're going to carry it out. But that trust dynamic when I came in was certainly a question mark there. You know, what is this director trying to do? And you know, is it going to make sense? I think people were really looking for those signals from me. And I played it straight. I certainly hope they took it that way. But I do feel like there were trust dynamics, particularly with some of the folks who have been at the agency from the beginning. And really were wondering how that was going to look. So I was conscious of that. And I think, approached things pretty openly. But we also had to, work through a lot of those issues, as you well know, and certainly appreciate your role in all of this at the same time, too. A lot of things to move forward with and take care and address during those early times. And then, you know, just when we get our feet under us, we have the pandemic hit. So that was a whole other thing.
Yeah. So, well, thank you for that, Kathy. First, I guess a slightly different question or put a different way. So, you said that sense of mission among the staff struck you as the strongest first impression. What were the surprises? So as you dug deeper, as you got to know the place, either for better or worse, what were some of the biggest surprises you had?
Yeah, I think one is just the cultural dimensions of the agency, having that startup beginning, but also not having taken the time to think through, structure and kind of effective ways to operate as you mature as an organization. Some of that is natural. Frankly, it just takes time. And there was a leadership transition. So good opportunity to think about that. That's also part of why I was, put forward as the nominee, was to really bring about that maturity of the agency. But a lot of, kind of individual people having the opportunity to, revisit things or not sure, what decision was made, the documenting of decisions, all of those kinds of things that really do help people continue to move forward, continue to build on what's done before, and have a reason for those decisions. I think that was one thing that I truly found as a challenge, and that accountability and empowering people. It's a lot of hesitation, a lot of individuals who were just trying to figure out what their role was vis-a-vis others and what their opportunity was to influence decisions. We saw a lot of those things early on. And so that was a big priority for me, was really making sure, one, that I was accessible as a leader. Two, that we set up the systems that would empower people to do the job they've been hired to do. That definitely was something. And others said it there. How decisions were made in the past, there was a big group meeting where everybody was in the room, but when you get a certain number of people in the room, it doesn't become an effective then decision making mode. It's a debate, and then the opportunity to revisit later. So really having that kind of a little more maturity, a little more structure to things, I thought was important. And that will take us to just another thing I know we want to talk a little bit about, but just this philosophy around how an agency should operate and kind of what drives, what risks it sees and how it approaches risk management. So the Bureau knew we had an enterprise risk officer who we hired not too long before. I happened to actually know her in the past, and a strategy office that had risk kind of as something that was important. But we really didn't have a structure at the Bureau for thinking about these things and certainly market dynamics. And so the question that I was asked, and I'm hoping you'll weigh in with your experience on this too, but basically was the You know, what is the market problem that you want to fix? What is the, you know, area of the market that you just want to reshape? And so again, it takes you to this coming in as a leader and coming in with the way I had been involved in my public service career. That's not generally what I'm expecting to get as a question from career staff. I'm expecting to get, hey, this is the framework we have in place for identifying risks in the marketplace that are within our purview. And here are the kind of the solution sets that we could approach, you know, approach that. So that identification of risk, that thinking about, you know, what response can we have? And also what's the lightest touch response we can have that's going to make sure that regulated entities are compliant, but yet still obviously have their own control there in terms of how they execute their business, because that is their right, consistent with the law, consistent with the regulations. There are options for how market participants decide to comply. So that dynamic of you know, is there a framework? Is there staff that has actually thought about this, has put some rigor to it, or is it a, you know, I just get to wave my magic wand and say I don't like, you know, this particular product, and that's the, you know, that's what we're going to do. We're going to go after this particular product or this particular segment of the market. It was, again, what is the basis for those kinds of decisions, and how should we put some more rigor and thought behind that?
So would you say that was unique in your experience coming, you know, from other agencies in terms of a focus or approach, the extent to which an individual director's, you know, preferences or preconceived notions play into the strategic, you know, process or integrated into the risk management process of the agency?
I would say it is definitely something that you have the capability to do, but the challenge, I think, at other agencies, but the challenge at the CFPB is just the level of independence that the director really does have. With other agencies, you know, you have the appropriations committees that can limit funding for different things. You've got a lot more touch points with the number of, you know, confirmed leadership in that agency. So a lot of back and forth with the Senate around what priorities are and how you're going to approach things, because you want to get your staff in. So you have to work with the Senate. So all of those kinds of backs and forths with the Office of Management and Budget, with your peer agencies and interagency policymaking, really none of that is a factor of influence on the director. And then on this, the rigor of risk management, it is true. In government, some agencies are really good at it. Some agencies are just not and don't have as much rigor there. But in an agency with this much independence, I do think that this conveying to the marketplace, you know, the way that we thought about these issues, enabling, frankly, those entities, the vast majority of which want to comply, help them understand the way that the agency is approaching and thinking about these things is actually better for consumers. I mean, that's yeah, fundamentally what this is about, because it's about protecting consumers in the marketplace. And so that opportunity to share that risk management framework and thought process and help entities understand, help partners understand, so that we're not at cross purposes with the FTC or with the FDIC or the OCC or others, that we are actually building up a system that's going to be better across the board for consumers. That's the part that really should be a lot more transparent, a lot more rigorous.
So you've spoken a lot about, you know, you viewed your task in many ways as trying to mature the agency through internal processes, through helping shape the culture, you know, that was formed as, you know, a new government startup. You know, I always heard the kind of foundational lore of, you know, building a plane while flying it, being the kind of organizing, you know, credo of the agency early on. You know, where would you say in terms of the agency's kind of life cycle from pure startup to, you know, mature, mainline kind of steady state agency. You know, 10 years on, it's interesting to think. I think it's no longer purely a startup, of course, but maybe not all the way towards, you know, a mature agency. What's your sense of how close the agency is in that maturation process?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. As you all know, I think for two reasons. One is the pandemic really did, set back a lot of the things that we would have liked to have done with culture. I just gotten the entire, at least Washington staff, into one headquarters. So we were going to do a lot more to try to, bring about much greater connectivity there amongst folks, not just based on, you know, who liked working with each other, but again, a little more structure around which responsibility areas really people should be working together and aligned. So creating those touch points was a huge part of it, certainly physically. You can do some of that virtually, but it helps when people have actually met, interacted, can see each other. So that's one aspect. And the other is then this transition, absolutely, because there is a bit of churn happening, some of which is totally natural. The timing of assuming that the nominee actually gets through to be the new director, there's going to be some timing dynamics there. So I think those two things make it hard to answer. I hope, and I certainly think we did everything we could to put the agency on better path with maturation, but people don't like uncertainty. They don't like a vacuum. And so there is definitely a time period right now where many of the gains are sliding back a little bit, just because people are uncertain and unclear. And therefore, all these capabilities to try to bring people together, people tend to recede a little bit and just wait to be told what to do, which I think is at least from basic fundamental things of keeping an agency going and doing the good business that it should do, that's problematic for sure with that backslide. So I think it's certainly on a path, and the basics are there, but it really does take that care and feeding on an ongoing basis from management to really engage staff, to get them to come out of their shells, to get them to raise issues that they're seeing from, all the interactions they're having, and to have that kind of dialogue going. So I have hope, I suppose, but I fear it's not moving as much on that maturation as you would expect. And just leadership vacuums at different levels also make that hard.
Well, speaking to that for a second, I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't note the recent GovExec article, discussing some of the personnel issues. You had an opportunity during your tenure to bring in senior executives of the agency. I guess the allegation is that some folks, unfortunately, in career service roles are being asked to leave or incentivized to leave to make room for new people. What, from your perspective, what does that do for an organization's culture? How does that, does that increase the uncertainty? Does it increase the kind of partisanship, or at least the perceptions of partisanship within an agency? As you came in and looked to hire folks for the long term, just curious on your thoughts on what the implications of that might be.
Yeah, I certainly saw the article. Know some of the folks who have made the decision to leave and for various reasons. Look, some of it is completely natural, as I just said earlier. When I came in, you had preceded me by a little while, but it was kind of that natural time period. People had been at the agency 7 years. I had, outgoing exit conversations with executives who decided to leave. And largely it was, they had been there a long time. They're looking for a change. So some of it is certainly natural, but people need to see that there is a path to refilling that, that you don't have actings upon actings for too long. And so that there is that direction, or really good communication, from the leadership of the agency and throughout the agency to make clear, kind of what that path is and why. Again, it's completely natural. Also, while you don't have a confirmed director, to be pausing on some of these things. But again, is there a conscious effort to explain that to people, to have that conversation and that communication? I think those things are important. And I will, I don't know what's happening right now on that front. So I have no insight which with to bring, or I'm not bringing accusations, mostly just talking from my own experience about how important I think that communication is and the expectation setting for those who are acting in terms of keeping, keeping things moving, keeping people motivated and engaged. And that's something that, that accountability, clarity around what specifically the expectations are, I think is helpful all the way down the line. So you don't lose that connection between the director and those who are on the front lines carrying out the mission. I think that's something that I would certainly suggest is important that they should make do with. And then, hopefully there is a plan. I mean, we spent a lot of time on the hiring process, on succession planning, on gaps in skill sets that are important and necessary, trying to recruit a much more diverse pool of people on all aspects. Frankly, I fundamentally believe that the civil service is best, it is strongest and best when you're bringing in, again, all of those vantage points. And so that I think is important. So hopefully maintaining those lines of communications, maintaining that diversity in all of its forms is something that continues to be important to the leadership of the CFPB.
I think that's an interesting observation because undoubtedly a lot of your time was spent on those internal matters, on the processes, procedures, internal maturation, and the hiring process, which isn't really externally understood, I think, the extent to which agency leaders have to engage in that. It's easy to see consent orders, it's easy to see rules issued or press releases or new guidance, but some of the intangible work that, builds an agency for the long term isn't necessarily known on the outside. So glad we had a chance to discuss that. I did want to turn a little bit to successes, missed opportunities. You've now had 6 months almost to the day to, reflect about your time there. Maybe wish there had been some more time, but we can discuss SALA and other implications later. But have you had enough time now to kind of think about what your game plan was, how you executed it, what you thought were the biggest successes, and maybe what you wish you had more time to accomplish?
Definitely. A lot of time to reflect on those things, certainly. But I think in terms of successes, it really starts with the approach to managing the agency. And we've talked quite a bit about that. So I can set that aside. But I think that mattered a lot to me. In terms of substantive actions, our innovation agenda is something that I was incredibly proud of, that I think really set the tone for the way that we wanted to approach things too, because it's recognizing that, the only way that we can truly bring financial inclusion forward it's supporting the best characteristics of the market, and the market truly is driven by innovators. It's driven by entrepreneurs. It's driven by people thinking about new and different ways to do things. And regulation, in some ways, inherently, just holds that back. So how do you think about ensuring compliance, ensuring protection as those things continue to change? And for anyone who's tried to draft laws, it's impossible to do at that level. As you try to draft regulations, it's easier than writing a law to accommodate those kinds of things, but thinking of everything through that process is really challenging. So recognizing there needs to be some flexibility, I think our innovation policies are at the top of the list, and I really hope that this gets a serious look from the new leadership when they come into the agency, and that they can continue those innovation policies. We really were very incredibly thoughtful about the way we went about it. We were incredibly transparent about the way we went about it. And I think opened up a lot of opportunities for companies to really be able to move forward, to show investors they're moving forward in a responsible way, and to encourage people to come forward and work with regulators. I mean, that is not something that, is foremost on probably many entrepreneurs, minds. They're thinking about how to build the company and build the very cool thing that's going to help consumers and help their customers. And so this working with the government and the concerns that would come from, sticking your head up too high and saying, oh, yes, I'm doing something different. How do I go about this in a smart way? There are so many historical examples of them getting smacked back, being just like, no, you can't do that. So how we interacted, I think it's incredibly important for government to continue to evolve and regulators to continue to evolve. And we've got some great things there. The second thing I would say is just the issues where there were not clear, political lines in the sand. It was incredibly rewarding to get the QM rule out, to really have the conversations around that, to start the 1033 process too, and recognizing that 1071 is also a very challenging area, but it is a congressional mandate. Getting that started in earnest, substantively, and really starting the roadmap there. So those were things that were on my agenda and plate. We didn't get to finish them. Admittedly, in that 2-year span, I knew we weren't going to finish them if that was the only time we had. But really setting a tone for that direction and bringing that transparency to all of the processes as the default way the CFPB would operate is actually that communication with advocates, with industry, with anyone who wants to talk to us. This is how we're approaching things. This is how we're thinking about things. What do you have to add to that? What are we missing? I think that, again, that humility, transparency, engagement is something I'm very proud of. And, covered in there a little bit of things that were unfinished, but, that's the nature of time.
Yeah. Nature time. We'll get to Sayla in a second, but obviously your tenure as director ended in January. If hypothetically you could go back and brief yourself circa 2018, lessons learned time, what would you tell yourself? If there was something you had done differently or had, advanced knowledge of, would that have changed in any way, the way you approached being director or the timetable, recognizing, that 5 years isn't always 5 years in this day and age? Kind of lessons learned, what do you think you would tell your younger self?
Well, I'm a huge believer in the serenity prayer. I think there are many things in life that we wish we could control that we cannot control. And clearly the beauty of that and coming to Zen with it is actually knowing the difference when it's in front of you. Can I control this or can I not control this? And that, I think that's a perpetual challenge in general. So I think, this position being CFPB director and the amount of autonomy that you had, the amount of really the ability to just execute and go on things, it is a tremendous power. And I approached it though with a recognition that if anything is going to last beyond my term, that these are not things that I can take lightly and ramrod through. So it really was a concerted effort to engage and try to bring staff in on things. Again, there's no question is a question I won't answer. How do we continue to keep moving forward and understanding each other? So those are the things that certainly guided the way I approached it. So I'd say I I certainly wished I could have created more time for some things to get done, but I do feel good about the approach that I took. And there was a drive, but amongst the things you cannot control is, again, people and what happens in their own lives and what decisions they make about what they need to be doing. And so it's, you know, people who make the decision to depart, who you really were counting on to take a leadership role in something. When you're, you know, an agency head at this point with 1,500 staff, I can't dive in and literally just go work every single problem myself. So I think that that whole personnel dimension of people coming and going, you know, and making the right call, I spent a lot of time on that. So I recognizing, frankly, that that was the only way also to kind of span the agency's responsibilities and carry that out. So that's also, you know, something that just was hard. If somebody decides to go, you're like, great, now that, that thing that I was really counting on is challenging. How are we going to adjust? Who do we need to bring in? And all of that just takes so much longer. So I would say probably some remaining frustration around some of the personnel processes that still don't work as well as they should have. And I made a huge commitment to the management side of things, recognizing this. You know, the CFPB has a lot of flexibility in how it decides to budget, how it decides to hire, could be a true guinea pig for more innovation in those government management processes because it's the right size, because it has the right authorities. And so we did some of that. We did a lot in different areas, but there's still more to be done there. And that, heck, if someone had done it for me, my job would have been a lot easier too. But it just the nature of where the agency was in its maturation. So hopefully that does benefit the agency in the future.
So I've foreshadowed Selah. Let's walk back to that decision. It fell upon you to decide which position the agency would take, join DOJ or not join the position of the administration regarding fairly consequential separation of powers issue. Can you walk us through, you know, your thoughts on the considerations there? Obviously, the position you ultimately took was contrary to self-interest in terms of what, you know, I guess most observers anticipated could have been one of the consequences, which is you know, rescission of the portion of the statute that imposes conditions on the president's ability to remove a director from office. Any thoughts on the decision you made and how it played out? I'm actually curious also to learn about, you know, the end game there, which is, you know, a new incoming administration, the Biden administration, made a decision under their authority post-Selah to make a change. I don't know, frankly, how that works or how it happens in practice, and maybe it's certainly unique in the CFPB's history post-Selah. So any thoughts on the case itself, you know, the process of reaching your decision and then the aftermath, I'll call it.
Yeah. Well, it was certainly one of the, you know, big looming issues when I was considering even the nomination for the position. I have tended to, you know, move through different government positions and feel like I had, once I had kind of conquered an area, I wanted to move on and see something from a different angle. So committing to a 5-year term was probably one of the larger things about this job that I had to consider as part of the process. At the same time, with this decision looming, it was also very clear that it may not actually be a full term that I would serve, depending on election outcomes. So it was something that was very much, you know, on my mind through the confirmation process. I had many people ask me about it. I said, look, I know it's going to be a big decision before me, but I'm not making that call right now. I certainly needed to benefit from talking with the agency's attorneys once I got in. And really examining the merits of the case as it actually, you know, made its way to a point where I needed to make that decision. So as you know well, we came to that point in the summer of 2019, having to make the call about what, I guess maybe it was a little later. So I forget exactly when, frankly. Now, COVID makes time just kind of all muddled together. But the timeline of having to really consider that and think about it came as the DOJ was taking its position facing the potential that the Supreme Court would take up the case. So that was really the timing. The agency does not have the ability to appear before the Supreme Court on its own and represent itself without DOJ's allowance of that. And so were we going to seek a different position? Were we going to concede to or agree to the DOJ's position? How was this going to work? So I did have the opportunity to think about that a lot. And the independence of the position was certainly something that I then had a decent amount of experience with. And fundamentally for me, I think that the independent agencies, there really is a lot that we should be thinking about in terms of how that truly fits in a constitutional structure with three branches and separation of powers and the checks and balances that happen amongst those three branches. And then you have these independent agencies, where do they fall in? What power does the president have to execute the agenda that he was elected on, given what can happen in these other agencies? And it was interesting. As I said, started conversation earlier about my interagency experience, and you know, all of that comes to a head with the decision from the president. And here I'm now part of this whole structure off to the side that does not actually go in that direction. And on top of that, you've got the role of Congress that I had to appear four times a year. But other than that, there were no controls specifically over my activity. So those things certainly influenced my thinking on this case. And I felt strongly that at least with the director of the CFPB, I will speak more broadly about independent agencies, the president should have the ability to remove without cause. I also thought through this presidential transition, now that it was a reality, you know, without that ability by the president, what would that do to the system? I mean, we have a very politicized agency. What is that going to force them to bring cause somehow against someone who otherwise is truly a qualified and duly appointed and confirmed director? So a lot of dynamics around this that just led to just very perverted potential paths if you don't just acknowledge that the president should be able to remove a director, recognizing that they don't, you know, share the same philosophy or values or direction for the agency. So I felt like from that standpoint, it was an easy decision. The communication to the workforce, how that might have cut across and trying to manage, you know, how they saw that decision. And I very much separated that decision from what the agency's mission was and where the agency needs to be. I think it was an important one and a discrete decision that could be made very clearly in line with the Constitution. And so the Supreme Court obviously made its ruling. And that led, as you noted, to obviously the president asking for my resignation right away upon his oath of office. So that was a fairly quick process. How that came about, I'll admit I was a little surprised by this. I was seeking some conversation, in kind of late December, early January, just to say, what are you thinking? I am responsible for this agency, its mission, its 1,500 staff, its succession and continued ability to carry out its mission during this time period. You know, do we need to have any conversations about what direction you want to go, what direction you want me to go, and how this will work? And I think, again, politics probably played out a little bit, unfortunately, as I think, because I've had so many people ask me, oh, how do you transition this? You know, did you meet the person that was replacing you? Or like, how does this work? And the answer is no, that didn't happen at all. In fact, you know, again, the president's right to name an acting of his choosing consistent with the Vacancy Act. And I did ask the question, but I was told that that was not any of my concern as to who I was handing it off to. So for a few hours, the succession plan of the agency that I had signed was in effect. And frankly, that wasn't even conveyed to the staff of the agency. So leadership knew that that was what was going to happen. But again, dealing with the political sensitivities, I wasn't going to go out and make some big proclamation about who my successor was. And nor would I want that person to be then, you know, have their legs cut off for it being only a few hours of power. So it's just it's an odd dynamic, less transparent than you'd want it to be. Very much based on personal relationships in terms of, you know, me reaching out and saying, what plans do you have? And can I at least have some kind of heads up? If I had not reached out, I have every expectation that the email I got at, you know, I forget exactly what time, 11:30 a.m. On the 20th would have been my first indication. I think there are better ways to do these things, but I'm also sensitive to the challenges that the other side was facing there too.
Well, Kathy, thank you. I see we're bumping up on the end of the hour. One quick rapid fire question. Care to share anything about your future plans?
Yes. I unfortunately cannot name the company, but I can tell you there's an announcement coming this week. And I am in this, I'm joining the startup world here, which is something I'm really excited to be joining the private sector in. It is a crypto native company that is looking to make digital asset markets more transparent to identify fraud and market manipulation in digital asset markets and really help enable mainstream institutions and others to join this marketplace. So fantastic to be part of this world and more coming on that.
Well, congratulations, best of luck. And thank you so much for joining this discussion. I had a great time. And thank everybody for joining this first hour. We'll move now to a short break for next session, which is what is the CFPB's legacy? It begins at promptly at 1 p.m. Eastern in 2 minutes. Please note that to join our next session, you'll need to use the registration link that is specific to the next session. If you haven't registered yet, check the event page of on the Federal Society's website where you can register. We'll see you all again soon in a matter of moments. And until then, we are adjourned. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.